Welcome to the Lax Worm and Coach Bear Show, your lacrosse odyssey for news, stories, and special guests. So sit back, buckle up, and enjoy the ride.
Just to get us going, a little bit of high-end music there, Bear.
Yeah, I love it. It's time to wake up on a Friday here, but certainly on the second cup of coffee, that is.
It is a second cup of coffee. I didn't play that music. I wanted to play this because we haven't played this for a while, so I figured let's have some fun with it. I'm also on my, 14th cup of coffee this morning. It's been one of those mornings. Let's introduce the one, the only, Jamie Monroe. Jamie, how you doing, man?
Doing well. How's it going, guys?
It's going well. Going well. You know, Bear said, hey, let's get Jamie on, because we were looking for guests, and I said, all right, let's do this thing. You have your own podcast, or a number of them. We were talking earlier, you have a bunch of different podcasts that you do, so you're a fellow podcaster as we are. It's always fun.
I wish I had music like you guys.
We could sell it to you. I'll sell it to you for... We're pretty...
about $10 and a bag of pucks.
Perfect. Sold. I was going to actually negotiate lower than that, so you're good.
I was going to say, I think that's $5 more than we would have negotiated.
So let's give you a little background. You were Brown 89 captain, huh? Look at you.
That's right.
Look at you. I even know you. You had 152 points. Is that correct? Do you know your points? Do you keep track of it?
Something like that. It was in that ballpark. I can't remember exactly what the number was.
Yeah, I'll break it down.
You know, 80. That was pre new rules, okay, of 1990, which is a big asterisk needs to be put on, just like the asterisk of the shot clock or the asterisk of five or six years of eligibility. Meaning, when I was playing, there was five poles and there was horns on the end line. And it was not as fun of a game when you didn't have as many short sticks out there. You couldn't score as much.
So you're suggesting that you would have done much better had we taken one of those poles off the field.
I'm suggesting that scores went up dramatically, let's just say by 25% at least, and that would have, you could just tack that on to all of the pre-1990 scoring, and all of a sudden, it's kind of like normalizing it, the way they normalize the SATs and recenter them and stuff.
Gotcha. So. And then three-time All-Ivy player, All-American. So you had quite a career at Brown. Take us back to Brown a little bit. We're going to get into a lot of stuff here, Jamie, so we'll be all over the place. But take me back to Brown, and you talked about different rules with five poles on the field. What was lacrosse like? And I don't want to make it sound like it's eons ago, but what was lacrosse like back then? I mean, it obviously was not as popular as it is now.
No, it wasn't as popular, and honestly, it wasn't even my favorite sport. So I was more of a soccer player up until I was about until really I was around 17 years old, almost 18 years old. As a senior in high school, I really kind of decided the summer before senior in high school, I went to the one and only recruiting event that there was back then. It was even before I don't even think there was the Empire State Games were happening quite yet, but this was the Rutgers lacrosse camp. And I ended up getting recruited for lacrosse and being like, you know what? I want to play lacrosse. So it was different. Having been a coach all the way through, I've kind of been a part of just learning, being a part of the evolution of the game and of coaching and all of those things. Things were much more hands off from a coaching perspective than they are now. There was not as much emphasis put on all of the X's and the O's and the strategies like there are now, and it was a little bit more, it was kind of in the mold that we all grew up in, which was more of a free play type of model. And because of that, I always wondered why, me and the guys I played with, there was a kid I grew up on the same street as this kid named Bernie Bonanno. He's a year older than me. We both played high school lacrosse together and on attack and college lacrosse together. And we had all these little sort of backyard, little plays that we did And I always wondered why, like, kids, as I coached more, really didn't do that much. Mm. Whereas back then, you know, you had all of your own little looks that you do, like, you know, just like that little fishhook look off the ball. And, you know, we called that special. Or we would just be like, you know, when I was a freshman, he was a sophomore. I was playing midfield because there was another, I couldn't break in a lineup. And so I was like, hey, Bernie, I'm going to throw it down to you as a lefty tackman. I'm going to sort of slide into the crease. Like I'm just going in there. I'm going to cut. Sure enough, you know, we score a goal in a big game doing that. And I always wondered why this was something throughout my coaching days that kids wouldn't do. And what I've kind of attributed it to was the difference was back then you were allowed to kind of do that type of stuff and you just did it. Mm. So it was more hands-off back then in a good way.
Yeah.
Not to say that coaching and evolution of all the great things out there hasn't been good also, but I'm really on this sort of free play kick these days and really, really into sort of looking back. So appreciate the question.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. We've had other players on that have talked about playing, you know, like, you know, Casey Powell and some of these, you know, the legends of the sport, so to speak. And they all talked about playing in their backyard and being creative and having fun with it versus, you know, being very rigid and structured. So it's interesting you say that because, you know, both Bear and I coach, you know, a youth program right now. I coach high school, you know, a few years ago. But it was like one of those things where you wanted them to be more creative, but they were almost, it was almost so structured coming up through the ranks that you lost that. You almost couldn't teach the kids that because they had to be doing that all along. Is that what you're seeing now?
Well, I am seeing part of what you're saying, meaning I am seeing so much structure that everybody kind of gets used to it. You know, it's kind of like in Shawshank Redemption when he was like, you know, you get institutionalized, you know, yeah. You just get used to being in a cage and that's just how you operate.
Yeah.
And I guess similar to when, you know, you get out of Shawshank that you struggle in the real world. You know, I think that people think that's what would happen with kids if you took structure away from them. But what I've found is that, that's not the case actually. And that you can, if you just turn your drills into competitions and let them play it out, you will see what I mean. And they will begin to learn all of the things that you've had a hard time teaching. Like, why is it that you guys don't communicate? Man, we used to communicate all the time. Well, because we used to play sports together. And I used to be like, all right, look, I'm getting him. You're going to get him. You're going to get him. That's what we're going to do. That's how you used to do it on the playground. Now it's all about scouting reports and the coach is going to tell you, they don't even pay attention. I watch these games of kids when you're like, how can you not notice? Like there's a short stick on the ball right there. Well, because they're not really, they're not geared towards thinking about these things because they've been in structure. They will figure it out. I've seen it, you know, on practice fields this way. I've also seen it with all of the free play that I've been working with the athletes that I work with and my own kids and stuff. And it's really amazing. What happens, you guys, this is, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, is that we as coaches will say, okay, here are our, let's say, offensive principles. And they're the most important things, things like shot selection and reading the defense, moving without the ball, spacing. These are all our number one priorities, deception. But then we say, okay, we're going to run this set and we're going to run these motions. And we pick all these little offenses and they're all great. Don't get me wrong. We all have good looks. But as soon as you put in your set and your motion, your structure, it trumps oftentimes the priorities or the principles of the offense. And you may say, well, that's not true. But all of a sudden, what you get kids focusing on is trying to remember the movement or the motion. And they're not reading the defense anymore, which is why you're like, dude, I told you to exchange out top when the ball's behind in a big low. But you were wide open. Why did you do that? Just step in. You're wide open. No one's on you. And that's kind of what I mean. So I think it's entirely not only possible but exciting to be able to take the reins off and allow the intuitive nature of these kids who are all good lacrosse players and they all have intuitive abilities to go play. It doesn't mean that without the structure you don't have discipline. Because you still have to make smart decisions with shot selection and feed selection and things like this. You just don't have to script anything for them to get the things that you want. And it's an interesting concept that some people have a hard time wrapping their head around. Mm.
Oh, Jamie, it's funny you just mentioned that. I think you just took me way back to the 80s when I lived on a country road, and there was probably like 15, maybe 14 kids on the within like 3 miles of us, and ages like 6 to 16. And when we played backyard football, everybody had to play in order to have a game. And it's like it was without being said that the 10-year-old covered the other 10-year-old, the 15-year-old covered the other 15-year-old. It's like you just walked out, and then all of a sudden, whoever had the mismatch in those matchups, yeah, that's where the ball was probably going to go. And it's like we never had to scout a report. It was just something that you just walked out on the field, and you just went to your matchup. And it's so funny you mentioned that, is it definitely brings back a memory. Now with that, Jamie, we like to talk about influences. You have you've obviously been involved with the game, and you have a incredible insight, and perspective of the game. Who would you say, high school, whether it was even soccer or any other sport, like going through, who do you feel you look back and you're like, wow, what I just said or what I just thought, that influence came from, this coach? Because we certainly all have had coaches that molded us in that in certain concepts. Whether it was college or high school or any other sport, who are your top influences in the way that you in your perspective?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question because when I think back to what influenced me on the things that I was just talking about, it's almost like the free play that I grew up with might have been the most powerful influencer on the things I was just talking about. And it's that coaches, when I think back to my coaches and I have fond memories and I definitely learn things, but so often, coaches in our era were more about just getting you organized and playing the sport. And it was so exciting to be out there because it wasn't like you played 80 games a year. You were in lacrosse season, you got your equipment, and the majority of the sports you were playing was not structured. So being in structure was just such a special thing. And I because it was more hands off, the coaches were more just these personalities and these people you looked up to. But certainly, the coaches that did have really big influences on me sort of influenced some other things, like Dom Starger was my college coach, and I learned an incredible amount from him, but I probably learned more about, coaching and running a program and recruiting and things like this over the course of time. Again, Dom at the time was just such a father figure. But he kind of like let us play. So that is something, definitely that I learned, but it was also just part of the way the game was, everything was played back then. There wasn't as much. I mean, it was almost like when Bill Tierney like changed defense. Everybody had to really start coaching. It was like kind of funny how that happened, but it used to be just be kind of a matchup driven thing. You had five poles out there, you'd just be hard to beat and have good goaltending and, sub your pole in when somebody misses a shot over the end line. Paul Hooper was a guy that was a coach of mine that influenced me a lot because he was sort of a cutting edge, had all kinds of really interesting ideas on the game that were always cool. He'd be always like, hey, three. He'd just call you by your number. Three, come here. I got something for you. Now, don't tell Dom that I told you this. And he would like teach me something. But, back then, though, that was rare from coaches. They did, usually your coaches weren't teaching you these high level things. Usually you learn the high level things like after a summer league game in the parking lot having a beer or from a teammate that was like, oh, this guy, John Lehman taught me this finish. That's where I first ever heard of a leaner. From a friend of mine from Baltimore. And so you like, it was like this pass it down model that was, really doing a lot of the teaching. So it was kind of this combination. Like I said, it was kind of like the free play, the pass it down model. And then your coaches were more like these just big influences in your life than necessarily like all about lacrosse, which I think is still true to this day. But I think the lacrosse side has gotten so evolved that there's just so much more detail in teaching.
Well, we were talking before the show came on, and you were talking about watching the North Carolina Virginia, and when you watch like a Lars Tiffany coach team, what you guys came from the same, you know, with a Dom background.
Yeah.
Do you see things in that play and you're just like, yeah, that's that, like, do you see little situations where you're like, yeah, I could see that we came from the same mold in some ways? Is that something that you see from guys that have experienced Dom and been a part of that family?
Well, I think so in many ways with Lars, but again, I'm not so sure I would say necessarily the product on the field is a big reflection. I think Lars, you know, has a lot of attributes of Dom in the sense that he's just so thoughtful, well-read, smart, you know, self-effacing. I think from a sort of a way he operates and the way he's open-minded and wants to hear about things, wants to learn, passionate about, you know, issues outside of lacrosse. I think that's probably more where I would see a similarity between Lars and Dom. And then I think it comes, you know, not just because he played for Dom, but also just because, you know, going, you know, Brown kind of, I would say, attracts some of those types of free thinking individuals. And I think if you sort of look at that, there's a lot of guys out there like that, in all different professions. It's sort of maybe the Brown curriculum of, you know, like literally, like you could take whatever class. You didn't have to ever take a class you didn't want to take. It was all about the interest of your academic pursuit, the open curriculum. I think that kind of attracted that type of person too. Dom definitely sold it that way.
Yeah.
So, I would say that would be probably how I would see the similarities.
So you go from playing in college and this free, you know, a little bit more of a free thinker that you are, but then you're emerged into a pro box. Like that, you know, to me is always interesting because it's just not, you know, box, American box was not a thing, you know, and now these players are jumping in with these Canadians. Let's talk about your transition. You know, how was that transition for you, and how did it open your mind to the game, and who were some of the influencers in the box game for you?
Yeah, great question. You know, when you were talking about the biggest influences of coaches, and I sort of said, well, I think it was kind of like more like my free play. It taught me, I would say the next thing would be box. Box lacrosse has been a massive influence on me, that game. I played one season with the Boston Blazers, and I was hooked. I was the assistant coach at Yale at the time, 92, 93 season. Practice was like a 2-hour drive, and it became impossible once the season would begin to get up there. So it made it really hard to play a longer career, but it's a huge regret because I love that game so much. And I learned so much and I got so much better. I'll never forget Marty O'Neill was our goalie. You know, you're allowed to have a few Canadians on the team. And Marty was like talking to me one time about shooting. He was like, you know, try. He's like, some of the best shooters I know, they kind of like lift their bottom hand up and it just freezes me just a little bit. And it just opened my eyes to so many things. The two-man game, the hole, the handle. I got so much better at lacrosse and I was kind of in my prime of playing. You know, but I was at Yale, so there wasn't a whole lot to do with it other than learn and try to coach those guys. Now, when I took the job at Denver, within a year, I started recruiting Canadians. And it had a massive impact on our team and on my philosophies and in my understandings of everything. I'm sort of eternally curious. And box had so many things that I hadn't thought of or seen before that it just really inspired me. And so that's kind of full circle back to the free play is these free play games that we are playing now a lot of are truly box. They're small nets, tennis balls, no equipment, boys and girls. The goalie looks like a box goalie in that they're sticks between their legs, it's not up. And everything you're doing is about finding the angle. And in about two-man games because you can't just clear space and run fast. So I am such a believer. It's not a surprise that Canadians have shot at 33 and change percent and change over the last, thir sorry, 34% and change over the last 10 years, whereas Americans have shot 28% and change. That game teaches things as it relates to shooting and off-ball play and IQ and passing. The field lacrosse just doesn't, and it's been a massive impact, and I love talking about it, learning about it, love watching it.
Well, you so you you go and you just mentioned earlier that you're at Yale. And we had Coach Bob Vogel on the show not too long ago, and obviously, what a just a iconic coach in our game, and you walk out there, you're coaching with him, and you got the opportunity to coach with the Towers and Double D and surround yourself with greats. And we were both fortunate to, I was fortunate enough to work at run and shoot camps where those camps still this day, I feel people can walk up and down those fields and just littered with coaching talent. Just I mean, I just probably built my drill book and my playbook off of the coaches that were there. And if you ever posted that list to people, they'd be like, oh, wow, that's like a Hall of Fame list of camps. And just surrounded yourself with a ton of knowledge. Like, how the experience at Yale and even some of the great minds that you got to coach there, the players themselves, how did that shape you and mold you? And then also, what was your takeaway when you left there and you're heading to Denver?
Well, Mike Waldvogel was a massive influence on me as a coach. It was really my first full-time coaching job. Mike, a lot of people don't know the name because, you forget about people, but for those people who do, they know that he is a genius. That guy is so smart. And it's like he's like such another level of thinking that he kind of seems like out there. He's a total mad scientist. He was known for as a player. He's a two-time world team player. He's a Hall of Famer. One of the great players. He kind of invented the position of the long stick middie. There's so many things that he taught me, or he was, that I still use today all the time as far as different concepts of defense, different concepts of molding a team. I think that what I learned from Mike, big picture, was that your defense does kind of mold your team, and that by pressuring a lot in practice, that it not only develops your defense, but it develops your offense as well. And that's what I mean by sort of it just impacts your entire roster. And to go in as a head coach, as an offensive guy, but to have had that type of defensive, background as far as just the apprenticeship that I was so lucky to have to work with Mike Waldvogel was unbelievable. So it set me up so that when I got to Denver, I hired an offensive coach and I coached the defense for the next number of, at least probably 5 years. I don't think I had, when I hired John Torpy, I said, okay, you take the defense, I'll take the offense. But I loved it. It gave me an appreciation and a love of defense, of how defense is like the backbone of your whole team. And so many nuances of everything. Mike Waldvogel was the master of like, hey, Mike, what do you think about this? And you'd tell him an idea, and he would just crystallize it and make it better every time. It was amazing. And we just had such great lacrosse conversations. He's a total junkie, just a great guy to work for.
Yeah, he was a great interview. We chatted with him, and it was just fun chatting with him. It was almost like, you're sitting down at the table with Yoda, and you're getting all these pearls of wisdom as you're going through it, and not even knowing it until after the conversation. So it was kind of interesting.
Totally.
So let's talk about Denver a little when you get out there. I mean, I talked about the climate, early on in '89, but what's the climate out in Denver now? I mean, you're kind of coming in there, and obviously sport wise, where did lacrosse fit?
Well, it was the summer of 1998, and I drove out there. The school, I'd flown out for my interview and stuff, and the school at the time was nothing compared to what it is now, as far as like they just invested $500 million in the campus in the next 10 years after I got there. There was no, from the perspective of our program, we didn't have a locker room. I was in a, me and Peter Hilgartner, who's my assistant, we shared a cubicle in like where the Tier B sports were put, which was in the dining hall, an unused dining hall of a dorm. It was like a ghost dining hall. And but I didn't care at all. All I wanted to do was just build a program. I was so fired up about that. It just didn't bother me what we didn't have at all. And I was just out there trying to figure out how to get what we needed little by little. the climate in Denver in general was, you know, there was, it, you know, it's, it was so much different than it is now. There weren't that many high schools that were particularly competitive. There were no clubs other than like Team Colorado that would go up to Vail. And, but it was great to sort of be a part of it. And you could kind of see the various people that kind of got the game going back then, you know, that really kind of organized the youth lacrosse, and it just grew. And of course I had children, so I have three kids, and they got a chance to grow up in this, lacrosse culture and, you know, being a part of it, you know, fundraising the stadium, you know, it was really one of the first big stadium, all, you know, dedicated lacrosse stadiums in the country. It might've been the first, can't remember if it was, but that was incredibly exciting. You know, we got really big crowds. There was a time when, you know, we played Syracuse in 2002 when Mikey Powell was a freshman. And, we had like 3,500 fans on a beautiful day in March. It was like classic Colorado spring day. And our chancellor was like, Jamie, we really should have a stadium. He's like, I will give you $1 million if you can raise the lead gift, which ended up being needing to be $2.5 million. So, you know, I was with, I used to listen to a lot of NPR, get my mind off lacrosse for a little while. And I heard this little ad, you know, they don't really have ads, but they kind of read them out. They're like, oh, there will be a book signing by Laura Barton about her late husband, Peter. And this book is called, Not Fade Away, A Short Life Well Lived. And I was like, man, I'm going to go to that. Somebody had told me that, you know, this guy was an amazing guy and I should meet Laura. And they were big in the lacrosse community. And I ended up meeting her. And sure enough, within, I went back to our chancellor. I was like, I think the lead gift should be Laura Barton. And he was like, I knew Peter Barton. Why do you think that? And I told him why. And sure enough, we got the lead gift. He kicked in $1 million. Bang, we had one of the best stadiums in Division I lacrosse. And it really made an impact on the community. Everybody began to rally around Denver lacrosse, and it was an exciting time.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when I don't think people understand from a coaching perspective the things that you need to go, and I'm talking obviously college level coaching, about the other things you need to do, right? I mean, you think it's X's and O's, and you got the kids out there, and you're going to put your philosophy on, et cetera. But at the end of the day, there's a whole lot of stuff that I don't think people realize that head coaches have to go through. Obviously, mm-hmm. raising money being one of them. How did you transition into that? Was that something you were comfortable with?
Well, I think I'm just naturally a problem solver. And so therefore, I didn't really look at any of this stuff as something to be comfortable with. It was like, here's what you need to win. Mm-hmm. Okay. You need to be able to recruit. You need to have a schedule, and you need a really good schedule, and you need to have facilities. You know, those are like the three things. So underneath those, you know, categories, you know, recruiting, obviously you got to work at it, but you also need scholarships. You need to have a school that's going to allow you to do it. You know, there's the recruiting food chain, and the schedule piece is, you know, you just got to be able to play enough good games to be able to give yourself a chance to be an at-large berth in the NCAA tournament. You got to be able to have that RPI and schedule and all that stuff. And that was a problem in Denver because we were so far out. And, you know, and then of course, the facility piece is that's a big part of the recruiting, but you need facilities. Like when I got there, we had no facilities, zero, nothing. We did get a turf field in after my first year or so, which was a huge help, but the stadium, you know, was just like all of a sudden, like could allow you to recruit at a so much higher level. When I talk about problem solving, it's like, you know, when I first got there, I was like, we need uniforms. All right. So, hey, Mr. Began, can you give us $5,000 for uniforms? Hey, we need this, we need that. And that was basically it. We need scholarships. I raised a lot of money. I would have lunches with people and be like, listen, I got this kid from Chicago. His name's Eric Swanson. And I can get him for $10,000 a year. Would you be willing to give a $10,000 a year gift for 4 years? And Pam Jones is like, yes, I will do that. And that's what I would do. And then how about this? I would like, I had like probably $150,000 of scholarship money that I was like in my like sort of bank account. And then I would go into my finance guy and I'd be like, hey, Dan, look, I heard basketball and volleyball are not using all of their scholarships. I was like, Dan, why would we blow all of this hard-earned fundraised money when you've got scholarships right there? Like, if they're not going to use them, why not just at least take the tuitions? Because the tuition dollars are like chits, right? It's like fake money. And so he was like, you know what, Jamie, that's a great idea. And he would do that, and I would just save my money, and I just racked up more money. That's how I was able to recruit, because if you're going to get Canadians, you got to spend some money. And everything like that, I figured out that it was easier to guarantee somebody, you know, $5,000 to come play us out in Denver than it was to fly back and play games. It was cheaper. So I was able to kind of just problem solve these things into getting what I needed to try to make a competitive program over the course of time.
Jamie, it's funny you talk about schedule, because, you know, I can remember a time, and people in the Midwest can probably appreciate this more than people, you know, along you know, the coast there, is, you know, really there back in the day, there wasn't a great difference between, you know, Ohio Wesleyan, Denison, Ohio State, Butler. I mean, like Michigan State, they all played each other because of what you just said, the schedule. Mm-hmm. You know, you had no travel budget, and quite frankly, the recruit, there was no scholarship. So the recruits were very similar. And, but when you went out to Denver, the Great West, you know, that conference is formed, and then obviously there's a push to separate that, you know, like that was the first noticeable difference between, you know, the D1 invested and then your D3s. And that transition, you know, was that something where, you know, that group was like, all right, we have to stop losing to the Ohio Wesleyans of the world. And you had Bresci comes into Ohio State. Obviously, that was a big investment by Ohio State. And Coach Corrigan, quite frankly, is 33 years of chipping away. I mean, I think he told me he was $8,000 part-time head coach when he took the job at Notre Dame. And that transition, that had to happen, right? I mean, like eventually it's like football in 1930s, like, you know, Bowling Green can't be playing Capital University. It's like, this can't be a thing anymore.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, when I got to Denver, DU was on a 10-game losing streak to Colorado College. So we snapped that in our first year. But yeah, I mean, there wasn't a huge difference between the Division III programs and the lower level Division I programs. And by the way, I mean, there's a lot of lower level Division I programs back then. You know, I mean, there was really only like 15 or 20 good teams, of which there was really only like five that would ever win a championship. I mean, for the longest time, nobody else broke through to win a championship. And there were hardly any breakthroughs even into the Final Four, really. So, so things changed, but, you know, the game was growing, and all of a sudden what a lot of these new programs in Division I were able to do was just recruit and practice more. And then they really had more resources, and then the Division IIIs couldn't really catch up. Like, Denison probably would beat Ohio State before Bresch got there, and it wouldn't have taken long for him to be a lot more athletic and, you know, and be able to just have bigger numbers and more practice time and all that stuff. And that's kind of the way it went. But it was fun to be a part of the GWLL, you know, to be a part of growing the game in the West. There was the Western bid that came into play in that same rule change that added the extra short stick. That was the same year. Dave Gavitt was on that committee that made those rules, and it was pretty exciting times to be able to get that Western bid. I think it did a lot of great things for lacrosse.
So you built up, I mean, Denver. I mean, I don't think anybody thought about, you know, Colorado lacrosse or in general, and you had the Denver shootout. You have all these things cooking out there. And then, well, I mean, just walk us through a little bit about, like, how does that, like, come to an end? Like, why how does that happen? You know, like you were the face of, you know, lacrosse out West, and I'm sure, you know, it's been a while and probably had a lot of reflection on, you know, ultimately what happened.
Well, you know, it was strange, because I really was kind of like, you know, even the star of the athletic department in many ways, because I raised so much money. I brought a program from nothing into being ranked You know, we had two NCAA tournaments, two top 12 finishes. I mean, there's a lot of programs to this day that haven't had. There were coaches back then that were like reputable programs that haven't made tournaments. And of course, you know, it's pretty easy to forget all those times because Bill Tierney walks in and he's the best coach in the history of the game and instantly going to Final Fours. But, you know, a lot of those players were guys that I recruited, Mark Matthews, Cam Flint, Chase Carrero, Jamie Faust, and Jeremy Noble. And, you know, yeah, there was a time when I was like really just bummed I didn't get a chance to see it all through. And there'll probably always be a part of me. But, you know, so what happened was that we just had this erosion in our team culture. And I had like my staff, by the way, was John Torpy, Bart Sullivan as our volunteer, and Matt Brown. We were on the same page with what we were doing, but we had lost some support, or I had lost support from administrators. We had kids who were getting in trouble. We had kids that were getting in fights. You know, there was positive drug tests. There's all the kinds of stuff that you're going to see. You know, the erosion of culture is such a fleeting thing. It's just so hard. You're trying, you know, we tried to do the right things, but it doesn't mean it always works out. And that's kind of like, you know, in the end, I resigned. I had a year left on my contract, but I knew that my athletic director, who wasn't the one who hired me, she was new. You know, I knew that I was like basically going to be like a lame duck coach, and I refused to do that. So I was like, screw it. I'm out. Go do something else. And I didn't want to leave Denver because I didn't want to move my family. I probably would have like coached again if there had been like the right job that was interested, but I wasn't going to go, you know, climb up the totem pole again. You know, and I did have the Denver Shootout is something that I owned. And I was like, well, I got that, you know, take a month, figure out what I'm going to do. And that's what I did. And then I started 3D lacrosse, you know, and 8 years later I sold it. And it was, you know, now I look back after 11 years, 10 years, something like that, 12 years, I guess, since I left you, do I regret that I didn't get a chance to go to Final Four? Sure. But I do not regret at all the path that I took, because what it really did for me was open my eyes to being around my family in a different way. Cause when I was coaching, it's all consuming. You know how that is. Like literally, I didn't want to be on vacation. I didn't really want to, I wanted to be in the office with my coaches, watching film, recruiting or coaching or talking about our team. And, so it's been, and I am still that way when I coach a high school team, to be honest. It's kind of funny, but you can kind of, high school is different. You know, you can put it down and actually like focus on some of the things that are important, like your family or like building a business. So yeah, it was, you know, a direction that I wouldn't have anticipated that things turn, but that's what happens in life, you know, and you just got to like figure out what you're going to do next. And, you know, I was able to reinvent myself in a really cool way and be able to move past it all.
But it's you say reinvent yourself, and I look back and I think about, like we discussed earlier, those run and shoot camps and having a high end recruiting camp like that, and then just the nature of everything that just changed. You know, it went from those kind of camps to clubs, and then you transition to, you know, club tournament in the Denver Shootout. Then you start 3D lacrosse. What was your mindset? Like, tell us how you built that. What was your game plan for building 3D lacrosse? Because it was like one of the first national brands, you know, that just crushed it and still, you know, is around today. And you know, walk us through that process going from a tournament, you know, to building out a national brand like that.
Yeah, well, when I was trying to figure out what to do next, and I was thinking about a lot of different things, and I was just like, you know what? I know how to do this. I'd already started the brand called Run and Shoot, which you're referencing, which, you know, when I was an assistant coach, you know, it was paying all the bills. I was only getting paid like 15 grand from Yale. So I had to figure out to be entrepreneurial. That's how I probably became a problem solver in the first place. But what I decided to do was, all right, I got the Denver Shootout. And it was like, It was a nice chunk of money. It wasn't enough to live on, but if I could do if I could do two more things, if I could get two more chunks like that, I thought to myself, I'll be great. That's exactly what I need. And so I'll figure out how to do that. I'll start a business. And it wasn't in the club business. Now, mind you, I had founded a club in Denver called the Mile High All-Stars, which was, I was using the model that soccer teams always use. Which was, I always noticed the soccer coaches always like coached club, and that's how they made money, and they got to coach kids, and if they lived within a 50-mile radius of the institution, it was legal. So, you know, I was like, I'm going to do that, and I actually got a bunch of other college coaches to try it out, and we started this Mile High Club. When I left Denver, I didn't really want to deal with club, and you know, those guys promptly turned the Mile High All Stars into Denver Elite, which still stands to this day. And not doing club was probably the smartest thing that I did, because it allowed me to focus on other parts of the business and get some events going. So I started, the first thing I did was get a spring break. I was like, you know what? I could do a spring break. I know I could convince coaches that I could help them on the field and essentially be like a consultant for them while and give them some value that they wouldn't be getting at these other spring break programs. Because I knew that the other guys had zero to offer a coach as far as lacrosse. And that was kind of what I did, and got that going. And it really jump-started the whole program. We had, you know, $750,000 of revenue in the first year. And this was 2010 during a recession. And it was like unbelievable start to the business. And I ended up getting a partner around right after that first year. And he helped organize the business. I was really the lacrosse brain and the biz dev guy, and he was kind of the operator. And that's how we grew it. And so it started like that. Then our kids were coming up, so we're like, you know what, we are going to do clubs now. The reason why it was good not to do clubs is because it does kind of bog you down. But the fun part of clubs is if your children are involved, which mine were, it's a total blast. I got to coach my son and all his buddies and my daughters and stuff like that. So we grew it. You know, we ended up expanding, buying companies, raising money. We raised $6 million, and we ended up having, I don't know, 80 full-time employees. Right. You know, in 2016, you know, my partner and I really weren't seeing eye to eye, and I was like, you know, let's make me an offer. And he was like, great. It was perfect. So I moved on and did my own thing, but it was an amazing experience. I learned a lot about business. And it was really fun. The relationships I made were a blast, and we did a lot of good things. I think we helped kind of professionalize the club lacrosse world, because we were so organized business wise because of my partner, and we were so organized lacrosse wise because of me, that it was something that was unique.
Do you see, Jamie, the club world now? What are your thoughts on it? Because, you know, the club world has become a little, in my opinion, tarnished. I mean, some of the bigger names are obviously, you know, have done well and do a great job. But have you seen these club teams popping up now and just kind of, for lack of a better term, I guess, you know, the money grab kind of thing? Is that something that is, do you see that happening? Is it frustrating? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I've kind of seen this, you know, all of the proliferation of lacrosse business, right? So, like, all the way through when camps were big in the 90s, early 2000s, and then all of a sudden the clubs took over and the growth of everything. The word money grab has been around for a long time. And, you know, I think it exists. And let's just define what that means. Mm. You know, to me, money grab is just, if somebody doesn't really care about the customer and they can charge a lot and not do much and provide much. And I think that the reason why that works, why that can work, is because there just must not be very good competition around, which is kind of why I felt like it was pretty easy to get into and go compete. Because if you do a good job and you've got some cachet, you know, then it's not a money grab. Right. And so, you know, a lot of people throw that word around. I just don't know why, you know, why people would subscribe to a program that is like a money grab, but I guess they do because they don't know what else to do. And then maybe not, you know, it's like in the, in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. So anyways, I think that's a little bit of how it goes, but I think that it's getting more competitive. But because it's getting so competitive at the high end, these low-end clubs can pop up because people just want to play.
Yeah.
And so so as far as club being tarnished, I mean, man, there's been so many the ugliness of the, quote, club wars, you know, persists. It was around. It's been around for a long time, and it's not really probably going to go away. And it gets personal, and it's very personal it's a very personal kind of just business, because everybody's expectations for their kids are so high that when they're not met in any way, or they feel like it's not being met, it's very emotional. And so, you know, people jump ship, and, you know, it is kind of crazy. It's kind of why it got old for me. Like I said, I love doing it on a lot of levels, and probably the main one was my own kids being involved. That was really fun. But the drama isn't something I miss.
Yeah, no, it's tough. I mean, I guess you get it, right? The parent wants the best for the kid, and they don't feel as though they get it, and you know, all hell breaks loose. But a lot of the club teams, at least from my experience where I came, I was in Connecticut for many years, there was like a couple club teams when it first came out, and kids would try out for it, and they didn't make it. And you had essentially almost like, not to bring professional lacrosse into, but almost like professional, had a lot of players sitting on the sidelines that were decent players that could play, but for whatever reason, didn't have enough seats on the bus. And that to me is where that money grab thing, at least the team started popping up saying, hey, we can make a few bucks here because these kids want to play. And that's where I saw it start to pop up. When you started 3D, and it was obviously one of the first national brands, as Bear said, what was the philosophy there? And how did you take me through a little bit of how, you know, how do you start that? You got one team and you're building to two teams and three teams. I mean, was it a success right away? How long did it take you to get to the point where you were branding this?
Well, the whole thing was kind of founded on, from a coaching and lacrosse coaching perspective, it was founded on, okay, I am going to treat this club program similar to a college program, in the sense that we are going to have a uniform way that we do things, a language, you know, the philosophy, an offense, the drills, the terminologies, everything that we used would be consistent. And it did start off with just a couple teams. Started off with a 2012 team that was Bailey Tills. There's a bunch of great Collins Gantz, all these really good players from that, you know, that are out of school now, out of high school for 10 years. But this group of kids, and then my son and his crew were our first two teams, and we just did we were more organized on the field, and the way that we practiced was organized in the sense that it was like you could tell there was thought behind the practice plan. It was the pace, you know, just like a college program. It was organized and it had a tempo. On the other hand, I had so many relationships have had so many relationships in college lacrosse, and was a good recruiter. So people, like, you know, if I say, hey, this kid's pretty good, just take a look, they'll probably take a look. And so I was able to kind of leverage that as a part of it. Recruiting is always, you know, something that people are interested in. And oftentimes they're making their decisions based on that, and they're spending their money for that. So the way I always kind of looked at it was, well, if we can play great team lacrosse, I can help your kids get better. I know I can do that. And then when the time comes, you know, I can be an advocate. And that was kind of how we built it. So I started with just a couple of teams in Colorado and a couple of teams in New England. My spring break from that prior spring, the spring of 2010 was the very first spring break that I ever did. And that subsequent fall of 2010, we started some 3D New England clubs because I had all these relationships and I knew all these kids from, you know, coaching them down in spring break, kids from like Exeter and Doves and all these different places. And they were all great kids and they all needed the recruiting support, and their clubs, you know, maybe weren't giving it to them. And I was like, well, let's do this. So we just kind of got it going and hired Dave Jenkins, former UVA captain and Boston Cannon, you know, 10-year vet faceoff guy. And he was an unbelievable business builder. And he built 3D New England into the kind of the empire that it became, which was, you know, a lot of revenue. And they do a good job. They're very buttoned up and they do a good job. You know, and then we just kind of popped up all over the place. You know, I can't remember what the order of everything was, but it might have been NorCal, you know, and buying Pete Worstell's business, and then Zach Burke down in Southern California, and then we popped some stuff up in Fairfield County. And I don't know, it was kind of it was interesting. I remember getting a call one time from this guy it was a 503 area code. It was from Portland, Oregon. He's like, hey, my name's JB Handley. I have a son who's an seventh grader, an eighth grader right now. And I can deliver you four of the best teams of the best players in Portland, Oregon, if you want to start a 3D, you know, operation up here. I was like, sounds great. So Sam Handley is his son, first of all, American as a freshman at Penn. And yeah, so it just kind of happened like that. People just kind of reach out, and there was just, it was very opportunistic. It was fun, the biz dev of it. Now managing all those, that many people and stuff wasn't as fun as kind of building it, you know? So I would say I'm more of a builder lacrosse guy than an operator. And that's probably why, you know, it ran its course.
Jamie, you separate it from 3D, and then you start, you probably start focusing in on your kids and, that's why I know one time you and I spoke, you're in Canada and your daughter's playing box up there. Like, you know, Colin goes through the recruiting process. Like, and as a former college coach, and now you're looking at your kids as like, you know, getting recruited, going to college, you know, from that perspective. And I'm going through it as, you know, for the first time as well, you know, and it's this very interesting process being in the father seat and seeing how coaches are handling your kids. And, you know, what was the appeal, you know, the North Carolina appeal and, you know, and then, you know, also now, you know, then all this COVID now at Georgetown, you know, like from your perspective, how's that process been?
Really, it's been really cool. Like I said, you know, getting out of college coaching kind of allowed me to build a business almost around my family. And it was really fun and cool. And luckily, my wife, you know, helped build the business and she enjoyed it. And my kids loved to play. And, you know, it's kind of like a little lacrosse family deal. When I sold the business, actually, it was in my son and one of my older daughter's senior year of high school. So back then, the recruiting process was happening much earlier. Early recruiting was in full swing, and Colin committed to Carolina as a ninth grader. You know, at the time it was like, I mean, I knew all these guys. I kind of didn't put myself, I didn't take any of the visits with Colin to any of the schools because I had Sarah go because I already knew the guys and I kind of knew their pitch. And I just was like, why don't you guys go and check it out? And I'd been to all the campuses. I'd sort of seen though. You know, and Joe Bresci has been a great friend of mine for a lot of years. And you know, he had opportunities at most every school, and he kind of narrowed it down to Virginia, Carolina, and Notre Dame, and he chose Carolina. You just can't, you know, you can't beat it. You know, and then you fast forward his freshman year, he was on the second midfield line and on man up and broke his thumb in the Hopkins game. And then came back for his sophomore year, 2018, in the fall of 2018, and he had just won his second Mintel Cup, which we haven't really talked about, which we should. The box across experiences that he had were pretty sick. But he came back, just kind of fired up to play, had a big role on the Canadian National Championship, Minto Cup, and then had a high ankle sprain, missed the fall, and then really never broke into the lineup. And he kind of realized at the conclusion of the 2019 season that it didn't look like he was really in their plans, and he really wanted to play. He was like, look, I've played too much. I love Carolina. I love my coaches. But I've worked too hard and played too much. I want to find a place that I can, that will fit how I play. And how does he play? Well, he's kind of like he's more of like a Canadian than an American. He played 10 summers, literally 10 summers in Canada, not like 10 trips. Like we're talking June, July, August in junior lacrosse, because the Minto Cup was like at the end of August. And he played four of them, but, so thankfully there was the portal had started and he put his name in the portal. It was stressful, probably for him but luckily there was a bunch of schools that were interested in him, and it was really, really cool. And he got an opportunity to go to Georgetown, which is an amazing institution. Last year, obviously, six games in, the season's cut. So he doesn't really get a chance to see that team in to the end. And that team was pretty damn good. And now this year they're 4-0 and they got Denver coming up next. So pretty exciting times, and the team's awesome. And, he fits into their plans and he's loving it. And, me as a dad, I just want to see my kids have something that they can work for, that motivates them, that allows them to be passionate about what they're doing so that they work hard at it. And that's kind of my philosophy on the whole thing. But it was an interesting experience, and you never know where it's going to end up. But it's ended up in a good spot so far.
Now yourself, you do the Lacrosse Summit, which is it has been massive, especially with the kind of came in at the right time with COVID times and people being remote and being able to spread it. I know. Certainly, we started doing our Midwest, coaches convention, because you look around, you're like, not every coach can afford to take, 10 coaches to the national conventions, but especially in the Midwest where budgets are limited. What were some of the thoughts, that you had saying, hey, the podcast, the Lacrosse Summits, what was the fire that you had to start those?
Well, when I was moving on from 3D, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do next, and I had to figure that out in the context of a non-compete. So what I wasn't, what you can't do is sell your business and then go compete with that business. So I had to figure out something else. And what I had carved out for myself was the opportunity to do something digitally. And I knew that I could do that. I didn't really know what that meant, because I wasn't an expert in that at all. But what I did know was, like, I knew that I had that I had the knowledge to be able to create content in the form of, in videos or webinars or something. Again, I didn't have any experience in doing all this stuff, but I just knew that I could present things because I'd done a lot of presentations over the course of time. And I'm interested in doing it, and I've become a solid presenter. So I was like, all right, I know I can do that. And then I also decided to kind of look into the aspect of remote coaching through video. And so I kind of went down the path of those two things, doing video analysis for athletes and also building out content. And then as I learned more about the digital space, this guy I was working with was like, you should really do a podcast. They can be really powerful because people can truly get to know you. And oftentimes the most serious buyers, the most serious people, I should say, are listening to podcasts because they're like learners. And then there's a great chance that they'll trust you now enough to buy something from you. So that's why I tried it. But as it turns out, I've been doing lacrosse conversations like this one or like the ones I'm doing, for my whole life. I just didn't always record them. So now I just get to do that. And it's a total blast. I started writing a blog. I love my blog. It's a total anchor because it's Saturday morning. I'm like, oh God, I got to write takes me like 4 or 5 hours every time. But I do really love it. It's kind of a labor of love. I just don't love it if I'm like on the East Coast and I have to wake up wicked early because I have something to do. But all that said, it's been a total blast. I've created a lot of content. I started this in 3 years ago in 2018. It was my very first coaches training program, and I worked really hard at building content for a while. And the summits really started in 2019. And I don't know, I did something like 130 webinars in 2019. And like 80 to 100 podcasts and 50 blogs. I mean, it was like, I was just cranking. And it's been a total blast. The thing is, I love lacrosse. I love to learn about it, talk about it, share it. And so doing all that kind of content isn't really like work for me, even though it takes a long time. So I tend to just I'd rather do that than like watch TV or watch Netflix. And that's what I kind of do. So it's been a real blast. The COVID thing has been a just absolute nightmare for everybody. But it did bring people into the loop of more remote learning. And I think that's going to be here to stay.
So Jamie, let's shift gears a little bit. You know, you've got, I want to talk a little pro lacrosse only, just for a couple minutes here.
Okay.
The you got a great college draft coming up. Lot of, you know, very deep, right? You've got the 5-year players, and then you've got the what would be the traditional seniors this year coming out. Who would you, if you're sitting behind, you're with Andy Towers, and you and Andy are sitting there, and you're saying, and he's saying, you know, who's out there? Who would be the one player? Is Sowers the one, or is there a player out there we should be looking at that says, here's the guy you should go after?
Man, that's such an impossible question because it has so much to do with what your needs are.
Sure.
You know, so is Sowers the guy? I mean, not if you're the archers, I guess. I mean, you already have Grant and Mint. Why would you get Sowers, right? But then again, you know, is it Jeff Teat? Jeff Teat is such a freak for people that don't really know. I mean, it's absolutely amazing to watch this guy. And I've kind of watched him for a while because my son played 5 years of minor lacrosse in St. Catharines, Ontario, and was a year behind Jeff Teat, who was Brampton, Ontario. And I kind of would watch him play over the years. And you just can't believe the way this guy scores goals. Like if you've shot on Canadian box goalies, you know how hard it is to score. Especially like NLL, not as hard. The goals are bigger, sticks are smaller. When you look at like minor lacrosse or junior lacrosse, the nets are smaller than the NLL, and they've got the big wood sticks. It's like impossible to score, and the way this guy scores goals is insane. In the 2018 Minto Cup, Coquitlam Adnax versus the Brampton Excelsiors, Jeff Teat had 14 and 14 in the 3-game. Round robin. 14 and 14 in 3 games. He's such a freak, you guys, the way he plays, and it's not going to change. He was the MVP of the senior league as a rookie. The last guy to do that was Cody Jameson. He is an absolute freak. So for me, I kind of feel like he's the guy.
Yeah.
Like he is, like, there's nobody else on the planet that can do what he does.
I love
Mikey Sowers, but you know, at that level, holy cow.
Yeah, I feel like Teat doesn't get the respect. I feel like, you know, everyone talks about him, he's in every conversation, but I feel like he's not getting the respect maybe he should. Is that me, or is that, do you think that's true?
Well, he's a different player than some of these other guys because he's not, you know, he's become much more of a ball carrier. He's much more athletic than you would sort of think. He's faster and quicker and stronger and tougher. He's wiry. But he's not, you know, two-handed X guy, you know, that can, you know, when he's being shut off, you know, like back in the days a couple of years ago where everybody was shutting off Jeff Teat all the time. And it worked because, you know, it wasn't like, you know, Rob Pennell could just pick it up off the end line and just score, you know, hang on to the ball. But that's part of what makes him brilliant too, is that he's not that kind of a ball in your stick all day long player. So therefore, he's more valuable on a team that's better. And as Cornell got better last year, they couldn't do that anymore because they just can't be playing 5-on-5 with all the other weapons that were around him. And I think last year he would have had the respect. I mean, he beat Penn State with the game winner, you know, in an isolation situation where they just didn't slide to him because he's such a good feeder. He got a shorty and he like did like 8 moves and scored the game winner against Penn State, and they were, you know, arguably the best team in the country. So I think that the pandemic really kind of spoiled Jeff Teat's true coming out as like the Toraton lead guy, even though obviously Ament is incredible and look at, you know, how Penn State has struggled offensively since his departure. But I think Jeff Teat's the guy, in my opinion. Like, I mean, he's my favorite player in that draft.
You talked about putting Teat in certain situations and his Canadian style. It's one of the things that I feel you and I have in common is, you know, you look at Denver when you were there and you had a ton of Canadians and you had Matt Brown. And like you said, then I was fortunate enough to have several great Canadians at Robert Morris, and still they're getting a slew of those guys. I always felt like that it was interesting because, you know, it was a learning curve for me to coach those guys and figure out, you know, how does their box game translate to the field game? And then all of a sudden you'd see other Canadians that you really loved. And I thought, wow, they would fit in great with us, but then a bigger school would get them. And then you just watch them disappear in the abyss of no goals and no scoring. Yeah. And I was just like, wow, they really just don't know how to use this kid. In my mind, that's how I would sit back and think. I was like, man, we could have used that kid. It could have been a 50 goal scorer for us. What was that transition for you? You know, going from Yale, where it's like, you know, not you talk about coaching the Canadians. I mean, you said you had some box, you know, you had the box experience. Was there a transition for you? And did you just see that game and say, wow, this guy's box game is going to translate amazingly to the field game?
Well, I noticed the same thing you noticed, where there'd be like these unbelievable Canadians that just didn't make it for whatever reason. And you're like, man, I can't believe that kid's not playing. And you still kind of see that. You know, like there are programs that are more alley dodging. You know, there's always a place for a lefty Canadian attackman, but there's not always a place for other Canadians, more Canadians. Unless you're playing, you know, nowadays everyone's playing pairs offenses and the whole sort of two-man side, three-man side stuff that Penn State kind of got going. I mean, you know, you're going to see probably more of that, in my opinion, as to where the game's going. Back then, it was, you know, trying to figure it out. I mean, I remember vividly the summer of 2006. Canada had just beaten the U.S. for the first time since 1978. In the World Games, my Canadian face-off guy and third-team All-American, he's like, you know, he wasn't actually a Fogo. He was a face-off guy that was also on man up and on the first midfield line. Jeff Slater was the Ferris and Best, which is the MVP of the World Games. And I remember thinking about, you know, hearing about that Canada had run some pairs offense. And I hadn't seen the video on it or anything. And it was kind of described to me as like, well, you know, they put Gary and Junior over here. And then they put like, you know, two righties, middies up high and two righties someplace else or something. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And I remember calling Batesy about it on my drive home in August from the office in August of 2006. You know, I think all of us kind of started going down this path of trying to figure out how to use two-man games and pairs offenses. And he took it in his direction, and I took it in mine. And, you know, it was like, how do we get – because we can recruit high – you know, same thing you were doing, Bears. We can recruit higher-level Canadian players that were also older back then, because, like, there was tons of 20-year-old guys that were, you know, not going to college yet. And they were junior A – studs, and they knew how to compete, and you would need to get these guys in your roster. And then when you got a bunch of them on the roster, you had to figure out how to use them. And so that's kind of like was a proliferation of all the two-man game and pairs offenses that we're seeing now.
All right, here we go. This is it. This is the surprise that Bear has for you. If I can, I told you the technical chops of this show is just unbelievable. Here we go. Never mind. Didn't work. Bear, I tried to use your theme song. So here it is. Jamie, you're going into the bear trap. Bear, I'll turn it over to you to explain it since we had a malfunction on your soundbite here.
Well, no, it's super simple, Jamie. I ask 5 questions. I would consider it more of a short essay answers. And then I just expect quick answers, and then we'll roll with it. There's 5 of them.
It's quick called answers. Bear Trap.
Quick answers.
Short answers. You can elaborate. You can elaborate.
Okay. All right. Couple All right. answers. Go for it.
Yeah. There you go. It's no brown, final exam, that's for sure. But it's up there.
No blue books?
No.
No blue books.
No blue books.
Thank God.
All right, here we go. You have been the creator of many names and moves. What is your favorite name of a move you have made up or that you have heard of?
Favorite name, man, I really do need to put together a list, but I would say Leaner. Gotta be my favorite. Leaners will go.
The Leaners.
I didn't make up the shot. Now let's just make sure we know that I might have named it a Leaner, but it wasn't actually I didn't make up that shot. I saw Gary Gate do it, and I me and Eddie Towers were kind of talking about it. So I was like, Lean. Let's just call it a Leaner. So we just drive around and shoot Leaners all summer at Run and Shoot Camp in our golf carts.
There you go. Love it. In your playing days, the best defender that you went against?
Well, I'm going to give a shout out to Billy McComas, who was a year older than me at Brown. He was a first team All-American out of Gilman, and he guarded me every single day. And was just an unbelievable position player, but an incredible takeaway guy at the same time, an amazing leader. So I got to give it to Billy McComas day in and day out, putting the pressure on.
So as a player, coach, owner of many businesses, what's your favorite lacrosse memory?
Wow. I'm going to say my favorite lacrosse memory would be watching the Coquitlam Adirondacks win the Minto Cup in 2016. And I would say the 2018 Minto Cup would come right after it. It's the most incredible sporting event. And just to be able to be a fan, I love coaching, I love playing, but when it's your kids, it's so special. And that grueling 9-game and 10-day event is so incredible. It's so cool, the whole culture, to be able to watch that and 5-game series overtime. It was an overtime win in game 5, and it was just unbelievable. So I'd say that was it.
Perfect. All right. Mm-hmm. The score of the Georgetown Denver game tomorrow.
The score is PPD.
Oh, they it is. I did not see that. Well, then we'll transition. How about who wins the national championship this year?
Who wins the national championship? I mean,
I'll throw it out. Let's change it. Pick who's your final four? Who's your final four?
Final four, I'm going to go with Duke, Carolina, Georgetown, Virginia.
Ooh, Final four. That's a heavy, heavy ACC. And the winner, who comes out?
I'm going Georgetown. Got to go with it.
Of course. I knew that was coming. And this is your final. This is your final bear trap question.
All right.
If Andy Towers was a WWE wrestler, who would he be?
It's a terrible question for me because I just wasn't. It would be a great, great one for Andy. But I just really wasn't a WWE guy, so I couldn't even rattle off too many other than maybe Hulk Hogan.
There you go. Definitely a Hawkster. I can see him being a Hawkster, eating his vitamins, saying his prayers. Yeah, I can see that. Perfect. Well, you made it out of the bear trap, Jamie, and yeah, that's yeah. No, really appreciate you coming on the show. It's fun catching up with you as always.
For sure, Bear. Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks,
Jamie.
Guys, appreciate it so much.
Jamie, thanks a lot. We really appreciate it. Great stories, great information, and listen to I always have a tough philosophy, right? The lacrosophy.
I know it's basically a combination of lacrosse and philosophy.
Yeah, you could.
It's really the Lacrosse Philosophy podcast.
Okay, I'll go with the Lacrosse Philosophy because the philosophy throws me a little bit. But yeah, listen right. to that good stuff. I know Bear and I listen to it, so it's good stuff.
And, yeah, no doubt. Some great interviews on there, and I think there's no question. Do a great job, Jamie. And I listened to your Petro one, which was amazing and great insight there. I mean, there's so many good ones you just go through. So appreciate you doing your podcast.
Love it, man. Thanks so much for having me. Have a great weekend, and let me know where I can track this thing down so I can push it out on my social channels.
Will do, Jamie. Thanks a lot, man.
Okay, guys. Thanks. Bye.
So, Bear, that's good stuff. Good stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, Jamie, I think he's been such an innovator. And like most innovators, there's always, influences and people that influence you. I think most people that are like sitting there maybe like, how does this guy come up with this stuff? You know, like what is he doing out there? And Jamie's one of those guys, that, like he said, he's a problem solver and he does things. If there's a need in the game, he finds a way. And, I look back on, there's a USA lacrosse VHS, instructional video that him and Mike did and has, Andy Towers is in it, as a drill, person and, McAlevey's in it. There's just like all these guys. And I remember I showed this video to my guys at Robert Morris, like, coach, these guys got buckets and, these wooden sticks almost, that's so old, but the skill sets and the philosophies that are in that video, which is funny because it's come full circle. Yeah. Like they were the free flow type, concepts. And then there's all this structure stuff that went on. And now people are going back to this free flow. You pull up those videos and you watch the skill sets that Jamie is emphasizing in those videos. And you're like, wow, that's innovative. And I mean, even Towers has a face-off, portion in there. And, his innovations, in those videos. And you're like, I would show those to kids today, And such good stuff. It was great to have him on.
It was, sir. It was. So another show down. We got have a good weekend, man.
Yeah, you have a great weekend as well. I'm glad to see you're getting healthier and healthier.
Getting better. Like I told you earlier, second day without oxygen. So that's pretty good. I just got to stay away from running around. That seems to wipe me out. But second day without oxygen. I'm feeling good, man. Thanks for asking. And we'll catch you guys next Friday on another edition of Laxworm and Coach Bear Second Cup of Coffee.